This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and coming up in the second half of today's show, we visit with Ashley Decker, a trauma-informed coach, as she tells us what's happening in our bodies and minds when we experience trauma. And speaking of trauma, we don't have to personally experience a traumatic situation for it to damage our psyches. And we are going to visit today with Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein. He is a Chester Fritz Distinguished Professor of Philosophy at the University of North Dakota. He is the host of The Why Show, and he is joining us for our latest installment of the conversation, Philosophical Currents, where we take a deep dive into recent news events from a philosophical perspective. Jack, thanks as always for joining us today.
I'm happy to be here, Ashley, although our topic today is not, once again, the happiest of topics.
And we are going to be discussing the racially charged events that are happening, of course, across the country, but more regionally in Minneapolis with the recent conviction of former police officer Derek Chauvin in the death of George Floyd. Jack, as a philosopher, how did you watch that trial?
The thing that I made myself the most aware of was that it felt to me like I was there, but I wasn't. Like virtually everyone, I was watching it on the internet. I was reading things on social network. I was immersed in both my community and someone else's community. So I was trying very hard to be an objective observer, but I also understood that the emotions that I was feeling was not just the emotions that were put forth by the lawyers, by the testimony, by the events themselves, but also the way in which my circle of friends and the news media has framed the issue. And that means that fundamentally my experience of it is very different than the people whom I watch. And I tried very, very hard to be aware of that, although obviously sometimes I didn't succeed.
How do you characterize how the media has framed the issue, and specifically, which sources are you following?
You know, one of the experiences of the internet is that I don't know that I can necessarily answer that question, right? I mean, I look at the Washington Post, I look at the New York Times, I look at the various news sites, but I also just follow links, right? I found out, for example, that this past weekend, the Islamic Cultural Center, the mosque in Morehead, was vandalized. Mm-hmm. And that felt more intimate to me because Morehead is closer and we have some sense of responsibilities. But in another sense, it wasn't more intimate to me because I'm learning it through the same sources, right? So there is this fundamentally weird experience of everything feeling equally intimate and everything feeling equally foreign. And the danger then is that your reactions become about you rather than the source of the information that you're concerned about.
How can we, as responsible news consumers, recognize when our reaction is about us? And I understand what you're saying. When it happens close to home, it's easier to feel more empathetic.
I think the first thing to remember is that when we are expressing our emotions, we're talking about ourselves. So if we have a tweet or a Facebook post that says, I am so angry, or I don't understand, or, you know, I think they've gotten this wrong, then we're not talking about other people. We're talking about ourselves. When we are investigating the circumstances or the ideas and we're asking, is there really systemic racism in our country? What makes people vandalize a mosque? Why would people feel so strongly that they would stand up against the police for something they believe in? This is about them. And so it's not a, I don't know, cut and dry issue here. And it's not always clear. But, you know, social networks especially are designed to call attention to ourselves. And so another question we have to ask is, why are we posting? Are we posting just to emote? Or are we posting to share important information or to learn more? And I don't think there's anything wrong with emoting, and I don't think that there's anything wrong with wanting to share the experience with others, But I do think that especially with very, very difficult issues like this, we want to be careful to make it not about us when it's about other people.
Yeah. How can you do that when it is an in-person kind of event? If somebody is coming down to help clean up at the Islamic Center, or people who took to the streets in Minneapolis or otherwise, and there are signs, you know, sometimes I'm angry or stop doing this. When do we risk the protest being about us versus about the situation at hand?
That's a really interesting question, because I'm going to sound like I'm changing my mind, but I'm not. When you are at the event, it is about you, right? You've shown a level of commitment. You've shown a level of care. If you are going out to the protest, then part of what you're saying is, I'm not the only one who's experiencing injustice, but I'm experiencing injustice. The people I love are experiencing injustice, and I need to express myself. And that's why being present is such an important variable, because again, if we are the victims or the perpetrators of these things, we are involved. But what the internet does is make us feel like we're doing things when we're not. The internet makes us feel like we have a commitment to this task when we don't really. Hitting like or hitting share feels like we're doing something, but we're really not. Going out there, aiding your fellow citizens, taking a stand, this is doing something, and then it does become about you because you've committed yourself to the process in a way that's meaningful.
When it is something that is an injustice, it's obvious that one side is not being impacted as much as another side, or often there's more than one side. Do the people who are not as impacted by police killings, in this case, white people, do we have a responsibility to use that power to draw attention, or are we better off staying out of the way because this isn't our lived experience?
This is one of the great questions of the 21st century. This is a question that divides generations, and this is a question that we as a nation, if not a world, are struggling with. Because, of course, one of the first things that you have to do is listen. If you have a gut reaction to something, you know, it means you have some sort of emotional connection, and that's often good. But that gut reaction isn't necessarily the most informed reaction or the most useful reaction. So the first thing we have to do is listen. And listen, I mean that widely. I mean, read articles, watch videos, engage with a wide range of sources that allow you to, you know, synthesize all those things and make a judgment for yourself. Now, eventually, you are going to have to make that judgment. And you have to recognize that there is certain privileges that you have or certain problems that you face in your life that are going to change that. So, for example, we also have to recognize that we use shorthand language. You use the term white people. Now, that doesn't mean that no white person has ever experienced oppression. And that doesn't mean that there aren't black people who are more privileged than other black people. It's a shorthand that we use to describe issues and the way that our country is organized. So as a white person, we definitely have to not take center stage, but if we learn something that we think is important, that we think is a reliable source, then sure, we could share things. Again, I don't mean to suggest that liking and sharing are things we shouldn't do, but we have to do them with the goal of educating, with the goal of unifying, right? We live in a pluralistic democracy, meaning that we live in a country that has lots of different people with lots of different backgrounds and lots of different commitments and lots of different choices in life. And we're all supposed to work together in some meaningful way. So ask yourself, does the thing you post bring people together or does it divide us? And I don't mean you shouldn't take positions on controversial issues. What I mean is, if you are talking about something that's controversial, that's criticizing someone else, is your contribution constructive or is it destructive? And, you know, in my classes, one of the ways that I talk about constructiveness in the sense is, does it move the conversation forward or does it leave the conversation where it is, or even worse, move it backwards? Lots of information on the internet is useful. I've learned a lot of things from people of all different backgrounds on the internet, but I can almost always tell, I should say, when someone is contributing because they want to really move the inquiry towards a place of knowledge, or where they want attention, where they want to scream and yell. And so, yes, as people who don't experience the same kind of oppression, the very first thing we have to do is listen, read, learn, and only then can we make some judgments that might affect our point of view and share that those judgments with other people.
So in general terms, because we can't go into all of the specifics that this has ever come up, but as you're watching yesterday's 93rd Oscars, there were a number of speeches where people brought up this concept of an over-brutal police force. And these are, of course, from people that I think it's fair to say most of us would consider are very privileged, whether or not they started out that way. Does that help advance the conversation?
Well, with great power comes great responsibility, right? The essential message of our period from Spider-Man. These are people with a tremendous voice, and they have a responsibility to use that voice, but they have a responsibility to use it in a mature and constructive manner. I mean, you and I have more voice than most other people in the region because we're on Prairie Public and we have this tremendous audience. I certainly behave differently behind a microphone than I do in a classroom. And I certainly behave differently in a classroom than I do in private life or on social networks, right? We play different roles. And so if the goal of the celebrities in the Oscars is just to gain coolness points, then I don't think that that's constructive. But if they recognize that there are, I don't know, 40 million people watching them, and that this is a moment in history where, you know, frankly, the Oscars are a little silly. I mean, it's important to them, but it's a little silly, and it doesn't really do anything for anybody other than raise their, you know, the fee for the next movie. Then the idea of having the Oscars when all this stuff is going on, it feels frivolous. And I think my guess is that fewer people watch the Oscars this year than in previous years, in part because it's just not as important. So, you know, we do have a responsibility to talk, and we do have a responsibility to express our voice. How much power we have helps tell us how we're supposed to express our voice. So for example, President Biden refused to say anything about the Chauvin trial. And he knows that as president, if he says something about the Chauvin trial, it can prejudice the jury, it can inspire violence, it can have an incredible impact that he didn't want to have. His predecessor, President Trump, held a different opinion, right? President Trump thought that he could say anything about anything, and he wanted to inspire that kind of reaction. You and I have a more truncated version of that same thing, right? If you and I are going to say something on Prairie Public, we have to recognize that we're going to influence people, but we're probably not going to influence the jury in Minneapolis. Someone on social network, who are they going to influence? They're going to influence their community. They're going to influence their friends who are perhaps less informed. They're going to risk their interpersonal relationships in a way that may be harmful in the long run to their friendships. And so I do think we all have a responsibility to participate. How careful we have to be about our participation is in direct relationship to how big our audience is and how much power we have.
We're visiting with philosophy professor Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein at the University of North Dakota. Jack, a couple of questions ago, you know, rightfully called me out on using some shorthand because we can't always get very specific about the group of people that we're talking about, you know, when I said white people. I'm wondering, we use shorthand or oversimplifying all of the time when it comes to social justice issues because we can't, you just can't have a rallying cry. For example, when people say defund the police, what they're saying is reallocating some of the money that's used for law enforcement and diversifying that into maybe some public safety, community support, some social services, having places for the youth to go, having some homelessness services, all things that can cut crime before it happens. But the danger...
That's a lot to put on a poster.
You can't put that on a poster. But are we in danger of oversimplifying it when we say something like defund the police?
Human beings work on shorthand. And I don't think there was anything wrong with you saying the word white. I just think we have to recognize that once we get into it, once we start talking about it, that these terms have baggage, these terms have history, these terms have complexity. So, for example, in a class that I'm teaching this semester, a senior seminar, basically, on citizenship and its challenges, we're talking about how the fact that race doesn't really exist, that race is a social construct. So when we refer to whiteness, what we're really referring to is power, is status, is a certain kind of influence that you don't have if you are a person of color. So we have to recognize that as human beings, we are always talking in shorthand. And so then you have to recognize that the rhetoric is going to change with the audience and with the goal. So, for example, if I am holding a poster and I am marching with people to get attention to the issue or to stand up against oppression, then I can say defund the police. But if I am going to the city council, or I am reaching out to my legislator, or I am writing an op-ed, then I shouldn't use the term defund the police. And this is where the shorthand becomes dangerous in a different way. The opponents of defunding the police keep acting as if what people mean is stop paying the police and get rid of the police. And that's intellectually dishonest. It's politically dishonest, and it accomplishes nothing but divide people. So when you talk in shorthand, you risk being attacked for saying something you don't do. And when you talk in shorthand, you also risk in oversimplifying your own message. But shorthand is a necessary and, frankly, universal entrance into a conversation that then leads to more complexity. And that ultimately, I think, is its virtue, is that it can get us to start someplace that will then lead us to more sophisticated exchanges and for us to learn different people's perspective in with the kind of depth that then becomes useful when we're trying to self-govern in a democracy.
What about when you see a response to Black Lives Matter, the response being All Lives Matter? What does that do to that, again, oversimplified slogan?
Right. So that too is shorthand, right? Because if we take it literally as a logical proposition, Black Lives Matter and All Lives Matter are both perfectly compatible propositions. But saying All Lives Matter right now is shorthand for I consider myself a conservative and what I think you're saying is stupid and wrong, right? That's what that means. It doesn't mean all lives matter. It doesn't mean everyone is worthy of universal and equal respect. What it means is shut up, I disagree with you. And so the proper response to that is, okay, but we're talking about Black Lives Matter right now. If I said to you, boy, the World Series is a great thing to watch, and you said, well, what about the Super Bowl? What about NASCAR? You know, I would just think you're kind of a jerk, right? And that's what All Lives Matter comes off as. Now, we have to recognize that there are white people in poverty, that there are white people who have bad experiences with the police, that there are white people who are victims of crime. We have to recognize that, and we have to address that too. But right now, the cultural lens is on this particular topic of Black representation and the way that the police treat Black people, just like at certain times of year, the lens is on the World Series and not the Super Bowl. The world is big. We have lots of time. There's enough opportunity and enough resources to talk about everybody, but we can only talk about everybody, you know, one or two people or one or two groups at a time, because if we talk about everybody at the same time, nobody gets heard and nothing gets done.
When we do focus on the one group that is being more disproportionately impacted, and then you have the splinter, you know, reactions, either way, we're not addressing the underlying cause of any of it, that people who are in poverty, that people who are living lives of crime, that people who have unstable access to food and housing, they might be disproportionately impacted by what you said earlier, systemic racism or just any other kind of life situation. And we're always, it seems to me, just dealing with the head wound. Yes, we need to address that Black Lives Matter and that they are being disproportionately impacted in this specific kind of violence. As a philosopher, what is your next level of, okay, when we can stop addressing the head wound and get to the root cause? What's your hope for that?
I think it's a brilliant question because, in fact, I think that what all of the protesters are saying is exactly what you're asking, right? I think when you see people shout Black Lives Matter or defund the police, what they're really shouting is address the cause, address the cause, address the cause. And I think the last 5 years has been a revival of people trying that in different ways. So you have Colin Kaepernick saying address the cause by kneeling on the football field, and he was kicked out of the NFL for doing that. And then you have people who engage in nonviolent protests saying address the cause, address the cause, and they're told not to do that. And then the frustration becomes so great that a small segment of the population, certainly not the entire population, but a small segment of the population, gets violent because what they want to say is, we keep saying address the cause and you aren't listening to us. And that kind of violence, if you want to understand, this is my personal experience, but I think a lot of people will identify. If you want to understand what it must feel like to be one of those people who are just, you know, throwing a trash can through a window or something, think about what it's like to get to Verizon or your cable company on hold, and they just keep putting you on hold or they keep ignoring you. I had this thing the other day where I was trying to fix something with Dell computers, and every time I brought up the issue with an operator, they just hung up on me. And I became enraged.
Right. I'm always angry by the time I get a real person.
That's right. And that for me was about replacing a computer plug. You know, my life wasn't in danger. In the worst case scenario, I could drive over to Best Buy and pay an extra $25 or whatever and get the thing, right? But I'm furious. Now, imagine your entire life is being put on hold by the system. Imagine your entire life is being hung up on by the system. The violence, the aggression is a natural, and I'm not saying it's right, but I'm saying it's the natural result of saying address the cause, address the cause, address the cause, and everyone only responding and saying, oh, well, you know, you say it's a head wound, but we say it's a shoulder wound, right? And so that's one way that we can use our own experience to enter into the emotion of other people. What happens that makes us so angry? What makes us furious? And how do we react when we're furious? Okay, let's have some empathy for the protesters, even the violent protesters, and say, gosh, what could have happened that has made them so angry and so hostile? And how do we address those causes?
Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein is a distinguished professor of philosophy at the University of North Dakota and the host of the Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life program. He joins us monthly to talk philosophical currents about the biggest news stories of our time from a philosophical perspective. Jack, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Ashley. It's always a pleasure.
Coming up after the news, we learn about trauma-informed counseling. But now it's time for today's headlines.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The 2021 legislative session is nearing its end as legislative leaders scramble to save some days. Lawmakers will likely come back to Bismarck for a special session this summer to deal with new federal COVID relief money.
We got $1 billion federal dollars that we don't know the parameters on, the rules, exactly how to spend it.
Senate Majority Leader Rich Wardner of Dickinson says half of that money will come this year and half next year.
But the half that comes this summer, we would appropriate when it comes, and we would have the two appropriations committees come in and work on it. And then when they have it the way they, you know, they are ready to kick it out, then we would bring the rest of the legislature in and take care of the appropriations.
Wardner says he hopes that session could come by the end of July. A House and Senate Conference Committee will be working on a proposal that all new state government hires after January 1, 2023 will be in a defined contribution retirement plan instead of the current defined benefit plan. The current plan has a $1.4 billion unfunded liability. The legislature has been looking at plans to help reduce that.
We are responsible for every employee's retirement under the defined benefit. The state is guaranteeing that.
Senate Majority Leader Rich Wardner says he thinks this will take more than $1.4 billion to meet the obligations.
You may take care of it now, but there are going to be a smaller number of people paying into the program going forward. So you're going to have to supplant that with a revenue source. And of course, we're looking at using the legacy earnings, a stream out of that, a small portion, to keep that fund viable.
Wardner says there is a possibility this discussion will continue into a projected summer special session. And the state Senate has again passed a bill that funds challenge grants for the state's colleges and universities, despite pleas from one of the conference committee members to kill it. Under the challenge grant program, for every $2 raised by a college foundation, the state would contribute $1, with the money going for scholarships. Senate Bill 2020 contains language that forbids colleges from working with Planned Parenthood. NDSU has been working with the organization to funnel federal grant money for sex education programs. The House added a penalty provision for colleges who may partner with the organization. Minot Republican Senator Karen Kresbach urged the Senate to kill the bill.
I do not want to put the presidents of our institutions or those institutions at risk. And this bill, the way it is written, it's a little bit far-reaching. And some of them have said, I don't know if I dare sign a contract if it's going to be subject to this, because he said my faculty or I could be receiving penalties.
The bill, as amended by the conference committee, passed 35-11 and will now be considered in the House. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. And, of course, in the first half of the show, we heard from Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein, a philosophy professor. And he actually gave us the story idea for our next guest, one of his former students, Ashley Decker. She is a trauma-informed coach, and she joins me now by phone. Ashley, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
I want to start with a pretty basic accepted definition of trauma being a deeply distressing or disturbing experience and or physical injury. And I think based on the research I've done, you would probably add a little finer point to that.
Yeah. So essentially, that definition, while it stood for a long time, when we think about trauma, is not really where the modern world is going in its understanding, and the research is going in their understanding of trauma. It's so much more complex. And so in my work, we talk about big T traumas and little T traumas. And that definition that you just gave would be what we would more classically think of as like a big T trauma. So things where we start to have like these associations of PTSD, mm-hmm. like war or some sort of violent occurrence or maybe an extreme natural disaster where someone would have this very extreme reaction, bodily reaction, psychological reaction, where there's actually little T trauma affecting all of us all of the time, every day. And that's actually where a lot of my work is in these spaces like relational trauma, things like the way that we relate to our family unit or things that happened in our childhood that aren't necessarily in the realm of things like abuse or neglect, right? It doesn't have to be so severe. Or even things like financial instability is a form of trauma, depending on how our nervous system reacts to that.
And when you say how our nervous system reacts, what happens in the body when we're experiencing, let's start with maybe the little T traumas and then expand it out if there's a change to a capital T trauma.
Yeah. So essentially, our nervous system is this brilliant thing that we don't talk enough about, but it is informing almost all of our behaviors, all of our reactions, everything all day long, because it is the most basic part of us. So I'm a big fan of Stephen Porges' work on the polyvagal theory. So that's what informs a lot of my work on the nervous system. And essentially, we have this beautiful nerve. I mean, we have nerves everywhere in our body, but the one that we really focus on is the vagus nerve. It's the 10th cranial nerve, the wandering nerve, and it moves from the base of our skull all the way down into our body and touches almost every single one of our organs and has all of this feedback coming up into the brain and then back down into the body. And it's constantly assessing whether or not we have safety. And so when we start to talk about little t traumas, anytime that we have almost a fearful reaction, the nervous system responds to our environment or it responds to a person in our environment. We're constantly assessing, am I safe? Am I okay? Is this dangerous? Do I need to have what we think of some of our classical responses to danger, like fight or flight? But there's so much more to that. There's fawn and freeze and flee and some other feigning death. Like there's lots of other responses that we don't really talk about. And so that's where this little t trauma starts to really have an impact on our nervous system. One of the things that I find, and this might already be like jumping off into the deep end, but one of the things that's most fascinating to me is that our nerves and our facial muscles actually wrap up around the jaw. And so even our ability to smile at one another is communicating how safe we feel with another human being and informing our reaction to them.
Wow. Can our bodies be having a reaction to a trauma that we're not technically experiencing at that time?
Yes. So this is one of the things that's most interesting is that as our body, so the other, when we start to really take in the brain into this, our brain is capable of taking in billions of bits of data every second. But what we actually respond to consciously is just a very small sliver of that. Because the example I like to use is, you know, we wear clothes, hopefully most of the time, at least when we're out in public.
There's a lot of working from home these days.
Yeah, maybe not so many pants, but when we feel our skin touching our clothing, we really have to maybe consciously think of that. Not often are we just feeling that on our skin all of the time. And that's an example of some sensory information that our body is actually responding to all of the time, but we're not cognitively thinking about. And so our brain does this great job of filtering. And if we have been in situations where our body has perceived threat, and has stored that memory in our nervous system, in our bodies, in our tissues, actually, then we can actually be responding to something that we aren't even consciously aware of. And then we just start to repeat past patterns and live sort of unconsciously to our world, which is where my work comes in, right? Helping people understand how their body is maybe perceiving their world so that they can choose to have a different behavior, so that they can choose to live their life differently.
Well, how can we bring that to our conscious minds?
One of the biggest things is to start really tuning into the body. Most of us in our Western world, in our American culture, we live pretty embedded in our thoughts, in our heads. You know, there is not a lot of time really felt in the body, having a real lived sensory experience in the body. We're kind of, you know, we think about worry and anxiety and future thinking, kind of going one thing to the next, moving so fast in our world that we actually aren't really that focused in this present moment. And so here's where we have some like nice overlaps into other modalities like mindfulness and meditation, some of these things that help us be in the moment. But then it's adding this extra layer of be in the moment and be in my body and actually tune into what am I feeling emotionally, but also what am I feeling from a sensory place? Like what do I feel warm? Do I feel cold? Do I feel tightness? Do I feel ease? Do I feel anything?
I'm always curious with that phrase, be in the moment. And I wonder, okay, if I check in and I'm feeling angry, does that mean, okay, I'm not supposed to feel angry and I have to do something immediately to change the anger? Or does being in the moment with the anger mean something different?
So that's a really great thing because, and I love that you use anger because it's such a, for one, it's one of the most acceptable emotions that we have allowed in our culture. So we can be happy or we can be angry. They're both okay. So usually what I find is that there's almost always something between our anger and our truest emotion. So for most of the point, it is, okay, I'm angry. You know, where is this anger coming from? Is there an event, an occurrence? What does that anger feel like in my body? If I sit with that anger, does it move? Does it change? And oftentimes it will. A lot of times our anger is covering up other things, guilt, sadness, fear, and then kind of sinking deeper and deeper into that. I'm a big believer that we don't have to change our emotions. Whatever we're feeling, I think our emotions are almost like signposts to our experience, right? They're helping to guide the way. So it's more or less, can we sit with it? Can we be with it and see what it's going to tell us about this moment?
It sounds almost like the concept of you don't need to treat a fever. A fever is a sign that something is happening.
Yes, that's a great example, actually.
So how does your understanding of what the nervous system is doing in response to both capital T and little t traumas, how does that inform what you do as a trauma-informed coach?
Sure. So I love this question. Essentially, what it helps me understand is that a lot of what people are experiencing in their lives is not actually probably directly tied to the event that they're in. It's usually just their body running the show, their nervous system running the show. And so when we get stuck in these patterns of past ways of being or relating, or we're, you know, in the coaching world, it's all about results and progress and getting to the things that we want in our life. So if we're stuck, I start thinking, oh, there's something with our nervous system that's keeping us stuck in this pattern, because if I had almost like a choice or free will, I wouldn't be here, right? This is suffering. It doesn't feel great. So then I start to look at regulating our nervous system from the bottom of our brain up, because good cognitive thinking isn't really happening anymore. So when we become dysregulated by trauma, or when we have a stressful experience and our nervous system kind of turns on and says, okay, we need to be in fight or flight. We need to have this sympathetic nervous system activation to respond to whatever threat I'm feeling. Often what happens is these other parts of our brain become dysregulated. So we have our prefrontal cortex. That's that good, logical, rational thinking place. We have our limbic system, which is emotions and memory and relationships. And these are, by the way, super basic descriptions, by the way, disclaimer. And then we have this next part of our brain called the diencephalon. That is more of our active sensory experience, our motor movement. And then finally, we have our brainstem, which is more of our oldest part of our brain, our autonomic nervous system, our automatic reactions in the body, like breathing and our heart beating. And so when I see someone who's maybe activated or dysregulated, or their nervous system and their fight or flight responses or their trauma responses are running the show, we come back to regulating the brain from the bottom up. So I'm not going to talk to you when you're in a dysregulated state, because I'm going to almost bet that your prefrontal cortex is not really working properly. It's not firing. It's not activated. So I'm going to start talking to your body first. And generally, we want to start with sensory information, because that's what the lowest parts of our brain is all about, is sensory information. So if I can give you regulated, rhythmic, pattern sensory information, if I can give you a beat, if I can give you a way to move your body, like my favorite illustration of this is, you know, I'm a mom. As a mama, we instinctively, when our babies cry, we pick them up and we rock them. You don't even have to tell someone to do that. You could give someone a baby they've never held before.
They're going to rock them.
They're going to rock them. They're going to bounce them on their hip. They're going to create a rhythm, because we just know that that is so soothing. And that's our nervous system. So that's what we start to do. So if I am working with a new client, I'm always assessing where they're at in their brain and body, how their nervous system is responding, and then creating these pathways to regulate the lowest regions of the brain. And then we build up and build up and build up, just creating regulation. And then all of a sudden, it's like the light turns on.
These pathways in the brain, are some people, I don't know if wired is the right word, but are some people wired to respond to little t traumas more than other people might be?
Yes. I love this question because it's so fascinating to me. A lot of times when people have either big T or little t trauma experiences, they will say things like, or maybe not even say things, but they can sometimes internalize this idea that there's something wrong with them or that they're broken. And there can be some shameful things about it. Yeah, all of that. And it's such a hurtful experience to live in that space. Yet what we know is that even a baby in utero, its experience that the mother is having can change the way that the nervous system is formed. There was lots of really interesting studies done around wartime pregnancies and cortisol levels in infants. And to me, I think this is just like the brilliance of our adaptive nature as a human species. If we were to think about this from like, put us like out on the savanna or out in the prairie thousands of years ago, trying to survive, if the mom is pregnant during a time where the environment is cruel and the weather is awful and the food resources are low and mom has a lot of cortisol in her blood, which is our stress hormone, baby in utero is going to be bathed in that cortisol and is going to have biochemical changes and nervous system changes that makes it more attuned to those survival parts of the brain. They essentially, I'll say become stronger. That's not the technical term, but they become stronger. And when that baby is born, it'll be naturally more adaptive to handle a survival type of environment. Mm. So now the thing to think about with our modern world, we're not out on the prairie or savanna. We are living very modern lives that are filled with sensory stimulation and filled with stress. But now our stress isn't whether or not we have enough food to eat. Our stress is deadlines and bosses and 70-hour work weeks and not really taking care of ourselves on this deep nourishing level in our physical body.
Wow. We're visiting with Ashley Decker. She is a trauma-informed coach, and you can find out more at facebook.com/trauma-informed coaching. Ashley, I want to talk about the word coach. You know, we accept someone like Craig Bull and his performance as head coach when he was there for several years as the head coach for the NDSU Bison football team, and the dramatic role that he played in turning that into a powerhouse team. Does the term coach get that same level of respect when you apply it to something like lifestyle coach or wellness coach?
Oh, I also love this so much. So the way that I look about coaching, it is no different than a wonderful sports analogy, right? So just about anyone with a little bit of experience can step up and coach T-ball, right? There's a lot of dads out there coaching T-ball, a lot of moms out there coaching T-ball with not a lot of experience.
Right.
And then there are our collegiate coaches and our professional coaches who have made a career and studied and done these things to be at the top of their game, right? Studied psychology, studied performance, studied their area of interest, if it's a sport, right? Football. So I don't think that there's a lot of difference when we start to talk about wellness coaches and health coaches or lifestyle coaches. Again, anyone can call themselves a coach, but it is understanding who you're maybe working with and who you're hiring that I think sets things really apart, right? Mm-hmm. We want to be looking for professionals. We want to be looking for people who have spent a lot of time on their education and experience and produce results just as you would expect at the collegiate level, right? Yeah. They're not hiring someone's dad to come in and coach.
I do notice as I talk to other people who have titles like that, like coach or even artist, that one of the things that they talk about a lot, though, is that time that they didn't want to step into that word. Was that hard for you to say, I am a coach, I am trained and skilled. And when you live in a society where somebody wants you to have, you know, 8 years of medical training before they deal with anything, that might be related to what's happening in their bodies and minds.
Yes. So I think this is an ever-changing relationship for me with the word coach. There have been times where I have been really turned off by it. Mm-hmm. For a long time, even as I had expanded into other areas of business, I still called myself a health coach because I felt that that had a different feel than a life coach. Life coach tends to be the one that gets like the worst connotations.
Right, yeah.
And now what I realize is that for me, my personal experience of that word is to help set the example and to help set the industry standard for what it means to be a very skilled practitioner in this field, where really anyone can hang up a shingle and call themselves this. But if I don't own what I do and I don't speak about it as a professional, then people aren't going to understand what the standard is. And there's actually a lot of training. I've had a lot of expert level, collegiate level training to be able to right. do what I do.
Right. I feel that way about podcasts. Just because you can start a podcast.
Yes, right? Yes.
I'm curious to know your thoughts, Ashley, on this pandemic year and how many now, after more than a year in this time, have started kicking themselves because, oh, we've had a year of all this time to rewrite the normal and you know, be home and we're not going to bars. How come I haven't learned Mandarin and become a master bread baker and got six-pack abs? you know, are we in danger of doing something there in that comparison of the why haven't we?
Yes. So the one thing that I want, if I had like one wish that I could communicate about this pandemic time, is to help people really absorb this idea that this was and is global trauma. We are all, every single one of us, being affected. Our nervous systems are being affected by this. This rapid change, the fears around COVID, knowing people, there are so many people that have had devastating losses in their family of people who have died or job losses or so much, you know, across the world, to be able to stop and say, you know what, actually learning Mandarin or getting my six pack abs, those aren't the most important things right now. Tending and caring for my nervous system and my physical body is the number one priority. And if you have felt any stress at all during this time, I can certainly say that I have in lots of different ways, whether it was distance learning with my kids or even just helping my own clients adjust to the adjustments in their own life with the pandemic, that all of that other stuff is just like window dressing. Like, it doesn't even matter if we aren't functioning really well in our physical body. So are we getting good sleep? Are we drinking enough water? Are we eating the good food? And if we aren't checking those boxes, then it's time to like tap the brakes and just do everything we can to slow down enough to give ourselves that care. That's what's going to help our nervous system the most.
Ashley Decker is a trauma-informed coach, and you can find out more on her Facebook page, and that's facebook.com/trauma-informed coaching. Ashley, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much.
Dakota Datebook is next.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
Support for Dakota Datebook is provided by Books on Broadway and Dakota Soda and Coffee Company of Williston, featuring coffees and a wide variety of books for children and adults. Books on Broadway, the independent bookstore for independent minds.
This is Dakota Datebook for April 26th. On this date, in 1877, Bismarck saloonkeeper Peter Brannigan was supposed to be executed. He had killed a soldier named Massengale in his saloon on Christmas Day and was almost lynched by angry soldiers that night. Brannigan was found guilty in February, escaped from jail in March, and was caught again in Audubon, Minnesota, a few weeks later. Bismarck was considered one of the toughest towns in America in the 1870s, but much of its past never made it into the history of the Wild West. Bismarck's lawless era began when hundreds of railroad workers began advancing the Northern Pacific from Duluth. As the workers moved west, so did those who entertained them and took their money, including prostitutes, gamblers, saloon keepers, and drug dealers. Collectively, they were called the End of the Track Gang. When railroad construction stalled in Bismarck, these people of bad character settled in for the duration. Two spots became particularly dangerous: Whiskey Point, opposite the Missouri River from Fort Abraham Lincoln, and Bloody Fourth Street. Two of the gang's worst were Dave Mullen and Jack O'Neill, who had followed the rail line to Bismarck, where they opened a saloon. No love was lost between the fort soldiers and the End of the Track Gang. Even though the soldiers were among their best customers, Mullen said he never missed a good opportunity to shoot or rob a soldier. One October night in 1873, a gambler named Spotty Whalen shot and killed a soldier out at Whiskey Point. The civilian authorities didn't do anything about it, so a group of soldiers took matters into their own hands. In what became known as the Battle of Mullen's Corner, the soldiers tracked Whalen to Mullen and O'Neill's saloon. Mullen answered their knock by opening the door and shooting a soldier. The soldiers returned fire, and Mullen quickly passed into the next life. In the winter of 1876 and 77, a man named Lawrence shot a soldier out at the point, and the victim ended up dying of lockjaw. Brannigan's killing of Massengale was perhaps the end of Bismarck's most violent era. Gold was discovered in the Black Hills that year, and the End of the Track Gang moved on, taking the stagecoach to Deadwood, the next toughest town in America. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Mary Helm. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
The newspaper, The Washington Post, went to court for 3 years to get access to secret documents and recordings about the war in Afghanistan, which is supposedly, for the United States, about to be ending.
So when you look at Afghanistan, every single measurable activity is failing.
I can't remember us ever saying, should we be there? Are we being useful? Are we succeeding?
We had to sue you twice to get our hands on it.
Wait, you did what?
Even by Afghan standards, I was in the presence of a totally evil person.
The just severity of corruption in our own system, I think, is just unbelievable.
Tuesday night at 8 p.m. Central, here on Prairie Public.
That's it for this Monday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, a complicated question. Can I recycle this? Is it plastic number 2? Is it number 6? What does that mean? Where can it go? Is it even going to be recycled at all? We visit with recycling expert Jenny Romer, the author of the new book, Can I Recycle This? A Guide to Better Recycling and How to Reduce Single Use. That's tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.